Welcome to RPGnomics, where we talk about the things behind the things that we like to think. My guest today is writer and story designer, Rachel J. Wilkinson. You may know Rachel from her work on The World of Darkness, Dune Adventures in the Imperium, some work on Scion 2nd Edition, Let the Streets Run Red, Cult of the Blood Gods, Time Becomes a Narrow Door, Night Horror Spilled Blood, which is COD, Heroes of the World, Mythic Denizens, The Rich Bastard's Guide to Magic, which is more fun than it has any business being. They came from beyond the grave, as well as your work with Jackalope Live Action Studios and other things that aren't that, but that also yes. involve coming up with stories and such. So Rachel, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm presentable. I know you as a LARP author first, and then I saw your name pop up in a number of other places in this kind of crying of Lot 49 Bader Meinhof effect. But you know I need to do an interview with someone when two independent people say, you need to talk to this person. Yeah. And you did a project called Port Saga. What is, was, or will be Port Saga?
Oh, so Port Saga was a audio drama that was scripted fiction. So unlike an actual play, it was me writing episodes of essentially the vampire world I wanted to LARP in. It was sort of like, here's the story idea that I wanted to do. I had two goals for it, but the idea was just to create a vampire story that wasn't, well, that included people who like to roll dice, but wasn't rolling dice.
Okay, so this is not like what Red Moon Roleplaying does, where they roleplay out it, and then they cut out all of the useful parts, and then you have characters suddenly changing their opinions of each other for no discernible reason, and then they win in any.
No, I decided I was going to be God of Port Saga, and started from line one to the last one, and wrote all the characters. But one of the things that was important to me in creating it was for the talent to be fans. So there are tabletop players, there are actual players, there are theater people, and you know, there were even SAG people there that were fans of Vampire the Masquerade.
So it's called Port Saga. Did it occur at or near a port, or alternatively involve the Portuguese fortified wine? And was it a medieval prose narrative in Old Norse or Old Icelandic?
No, but it does take place in a fictional city that is essentially Norfolk. So that sort of Northern Virginia area, but it is a Port Saga and Moonlight Bay. Moonlight Bay is essentially the Norfolk, where Port Saga is, I think that's Hampton Roads, something like that. It's the smaller place across the bay. Somebody from Virginia is going to call me up and say that's actually not real, but please forgive me. They were fictional.
I don't want to mess with Virginians. Having become familiar with their state flag, it's the only one that both threatens death and has a boob out. So that I don't want to mess with Virginians. In other news, they need a new state flag.
And it's important for me to bring this up, especially when we talk about the later things, is because I wanted it to be a fictional place because I didn't want to step on anybody's toes. So I was sort of like, I don't know what local games you guys have going on. I don't know what actual plays. I don't know what Twitter streams are out there. I don't know what's going on. So I was just going to have my little sandbox and play in it.
And it's always weird because, like, as a mage writer, it's nice to just make up things about cultures that don't exist because it can't be wrong and you're probably not appropriating. So that's always nice. But then in LARP, you find out that there are these rare, weird things where you're like, oh, this LARP in Exeter, Massachusetts has 175 people and 9 out of every 5 people in this town apparently is a supernatural. This is amazing.
Yes.
So you, one of the things that's always interesting when you are making an entirely fictional product that is not directly guided by the system is, were you informed by it? Did it feel like something that could occur in a game or at a table? Or was the World of Darkness just kind of a starting point for you?
I think it could have. I think the World of Darkness was a starting point. The real starting point was me being interested in making an audio drama. I thought it was a really interesting challenge to try to use only sound to essentially make television. I'm very interested in trying to make television. I would love to have a television series. I do not have the money or the investors or the backing to do any of that. But audio drama was sort of like an adjacent kind of project that allowed me to play in that sphere. And so I was sitting there talking to my husband, actually sitting on the floor of his office, being like, I really want to do this thing, but I don't have any idea what I want to do it about. What should I write about? I don't know anything. I don't know what's good. And the whole time I'm saying this, there's a shelf by the side of my head that is just 1,000 vampire books, right? You know, a handful of them I had written in. And my husband is just looking between me and the vampire books going, you don't know about something? Are you sure, Rachel? And so it was putting that two and two together that I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I can do a Vampire the Masquerade story. So I would consider it definitely a Vampire the Masquerade story. There were no roles involved. I did make sheets. You know, people had sheets. I knew their power levels. I knew the disciplines that they had. They were based on the rules of character creation, new characters with like just a little bit of XP on them. But I didn't sit there and say, okay, my narrative is going to change because I have rolled this and by chance this power didn't work or did.
How far into it did you start? So you have an idea for a setting, you have these character sheets, you have friends or contacts or people you know, or you put out a casting call to kind of get people. Did you plan out the first episode? Did you plan out the first 5 episodes? Did you figure out story beats?
I planned out the whole first series. So it's two seasons of the entire series. And there's a picture of me somewhere where all of my note cards are stretched out across my entire living room. So I started, and originally I just knew the beginning and how it ended, like what those plot points were going to be. And then I spent a lot of time going through and just working out A plot, B plot, C plot, you know, as you would, just kind of crafting the story.
Did you have previous experience with dialogue and, I guess, what I would call the libretto, a script? That's the word that normal people use to describe words on a page, directing actors and such. Did you have it at the script level when people sat down, or was there some sort of collaboration with the talent?
No, I was God. I'm a control freak. Hi, my name is Rachel. I actually wrote everything and then handed folks scripts. But I started out originally in educational content for consumer economics and financial literacy. Like when you go in the Wayback Machine, I used to make videos. I would write, direct, edit, film, all the things for like how to write a check in a checkbook, how to use a credit card, whatever you saw in high school that, you know,
you which is now Rachel no longer Wilkinson's instructed name in, on in it. High school. Yeah.
Yeah. So my first experience in writing and working with talent and doing that came from years ago in education. And then I came back around to it. And at that time too, because I had the in-house studio, I did have access to cameras. I did have access to all of the equipment that you would need for making films, but on my own, not so much. And so that's why, another reason why I switched to the audio format, because it had a lot of the same aspects. It was just more approachable.
And how much of the finished product outside of the talent is you? Did you do all the audio editing? You did the scripting and everything?
Yes. So it was all the scripting, all the audio editing, all the everything. Yes. I did not create the music, but I did pick the music that came from one of those music services, licensing services. And then I had an audio engineer who would mix it for me. So that's Brandon. And so whenever I finished the sound design of an episode, I would shoot it off to Brandon and he would balance the levels and make sure that they were appropriate for Spotify and Apple and, you know, distribution.
For lack of a better term, how did it do, both in terms of how did you feel about the product that came out the end and how was it received?
Excellently. Like it did excellently. I think at this point, we're over 150,000 downloads on it for 20 episodes over the course of 2 years. I'm like, that's pretty good. I think fans generally love it. I know there's a group of fans that I lost on episode 3. That there is, yes. So I have these, you could, as you know, doing a podcast, you can look at your numbers. You can look at your downloads. You can look at also how long they listen to an episode. And inevitably what happens is I have a lot of people try it out. I know exactly when I lose them, but it is in episode 3, I lose a third of the audience.
That's surprisingly good, though. I mean, it is not uncommon for an actual play or something similar to have the audience literally half each episode for the first five episodes.
Yes. Yes, that is true. People decide, am I interested in this? No, I'm not. And then they walk away. But I made people mad in the third episode. And I know when I made them mad. And I don't want to give it away in case anybody wants
to
listen.
That is fine.
But I knew that if you kept listening after episode three, you were my people.
Yeah.
Like, we were in it to the end together.
Yes, the crucible, as it were,
yes.
Of that production. And what platform does or did that go out over?
All of them that I could. You know, it was a general RSS feed release, so yeah.
That would explain the skywriting I had seen advertising it. So you had this thing, it was up and coming. Were you paying the talent?
Yeah, I paid half the talent. The other half worked voluntarily. Thank you guys. I really appreciate it. I was not paying anyone well.
Yes, but regardless.
Yes. So the longer story is that I had had this idea and I had reached out to Paradox World of Darkness and had said, hey, are you interested in sponsoring this, supporting this, paying me to produce this? Is this something that's of interest to you? And they were not interested. The reason I was told was a very polite way of saying, we haven't quite heard this done as well as we would want to our standards. I also had no product to show them. I didn't have a previous audio drama to say, hey, take a listen to this. I know what I'm doing.
What stage in the production did you, was this conversation? Was it already out in the world or were you about to?
No, this is before. I knew the story, but before I really got into writing it, I was sort of like, am I going to spend my time doing this if it's not going to go anywhere? I don't know. I was really on the fence. So I reached out and, like I said, weren't interested, and I didn't really blame them. So I understood that if I made this first season, that it was going to be a proof of concept. I knew that I was going to be putting my own money into it and I was going to be paying for the whole thing. And that it was to essentially say, hey, look, this thing can be real. I do know what I'm doing. I think I know what I'm doing. Maybe somebody will disagree, but, you know, give this thing a shot. And so because it was all coming out of my own pocket, yes, I had volunteers who were very kind, who were very dear friends, and actors who accepted dinners in some cases. Not much of pay, but they were vampire fans. And so part of it was, oh, I get to play a cool vampire in this thing. Great. And the nice thing about audio drama too, is that it's the difference of an actual play where a person is committing four nights of their life, maybe for, you know, 16 hours, 20 hours to do an actual play, where I would need somebody for an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and we could do the whole season. So it was also a pretty easy trade-off that's like, hey, you're going to come to my house. I'm going to buy you dinner. We're going to spend 45 minutes in my recording room, and then you're going to get to go home. And they're like, sure, whatever, you know? So it wasn't a huge time commitment, but I do appreciate those that decided to do it out of the kindness of their hearts, for sure.
So you produce this first season, it goes out into the world, it's well received. Did you then have a follow-up conversation with Paradox, the license holder? What happened there, Rachel?
They still weren't interested. Yeah, no, they still weren't. I had created a whole thing about target audience and downloads and all of the things that I thought that they would want to see. And that was still not something that they wanted to, God, you know, I don't know how to say it because it was created on the dark pack. And so they have a lot of rules about their ability to be involved with dark pact projects. And a lot of the decisions that I had made, especially that it was a fictional city, limited them from being able to be part of it. So what I didn't realize at the time was that they would not support fictional cities. Had I known that previously, maybe I would have gone ahead and made something based on an actual city. But they also weren't able to support it through social media or to put any financial backing behind it because they felt it would be showing favoritism to one project over another. And so they didn't want to do anything with it.
So let's talk about Dark Pact for a moment. So the World of Darkness is a piece of intellectual property that is owned by Paradox, Paradox Interactive. It was formerly overseen by White Wolf, which was folded in as it was kind of its own company, and then it was purchased by CCP, and then it was purchased by Paradox, and then it was just kind of a brand or an imprint. And then after some difficulties with it, it was removed as an entity, and now it is just overseen by Paradox. And it basically says you don't need to ask their permission before creating and sharing most types of non-commercial content. You can stream your actual play, you can run a LARP, you can make a fan short if it is non-commercial. You can monetize the videos on the platforms that allow it. YouTube, so you can be a YouTube affiliate or you can be a Twitch stream affiliate and gather funds through optional subscription services, Twitch, Patreon, Ko-fi. If you produce a publication, Charlie Cantrell's Changeling 5th Edition comes to mind. You can do it. It just has to be free. It has to be available to everyone. They have a more extensive one for applications because they also allow you to make games and so on. There's things you can have like Vamp Bucks or like buy 10,000 Vitae pack or something like that. And it covers a wide number of things. But as you mentioned, there are some weird restrictions on it. So for instance, in the World of Darkness, you cannot have a fictional location. That is a requirement on the Storyteller's Vault, which is the community content portal for World of Darkness licensed material, where the agreement is you make half, they get the rest. More accurately, 20 to 30% goes to DriveThruRPG, and then Paradox gets the remaining share. You can't create utterly novel settings. You can't create alternate realities. You can't do an F20 fantasy vampire. You can't do like Vampire of Forgotten Realms or Al-Qadim, as weird as that would be, which immediately makes me think of the horrible crossover shirts you see at like pop culture conventions where someone's like, to quote Penny Arcade, my other TARDIS is an X-Wing. And you're like, what is even happening? Pick a lane. That was changed later in a content update in October of 2022, where they said, ta-da, you can do fictional stuff now.
I was part of that effort to try to get it changed. Yeah.
And it's a weird rule to have. I get that they don't want you to create a World of Darkness, Gotham, or Sunnyvale, but like, if I want to set my game in the most generic of Rust Belt towns, or an area where everyone's like a poor turd farmer, I don't want to literally... Pardon me. I don't want to have to figuratively shit on Gary, Indiana to get my post-industrial wasteland point across and be like, look at these pores.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a choice. So kind of what did that second decline from them force you to do? Did that change your creative choices? Did that limit your ability to maneuver? What did that do to the model that you had been using to make this thing a reality?
More money came out of my pocket. That's essentially what it was. I understood the restriction on they didn't want vampires on the moon. And you know, if they didn't have it in there, somebody would put vampires on the moon. And they just didn't want their prestige label to become silly, to become comical. They're supposed to be super serious, goth punk, urban fantasy with this horror aspect. And then they didn't want to turn into a clown show. And so I understood, but I like you, I'm sort of like, okay, there's a far cry from vampires on the moon to I happen to be using a fictional port city where everything is still real, but it's based on the creator and they couldn't police or oversee all of those projects, nor do they want to. I mean, the whole point is so that people can play the game and people can do their stuff and not have this constant oversight. And so one of the things that I had done in creating season one is I opened up a Patreon because that's one of the things that you can do. And I had, once again, at the time had hoped that I would be able to do a Kickstarter. I would learn later that that was also not allowed, that crowdfunding was not possible. And so I started the Patreon and the patrons page to try to get the funding for season two. I did get the funding back for season one. I was able to take, you know, the donations that came from the Patreon page and reimburse myself for the first season. I was not able to get season two paid for. Season two was a little bit more expensive because I wanted to do a better production. But I also felt committed to season two because it was what I needed to at least finish the story in the briefest way. I actually had a 3-season arc, but I knew I could finish it in 2 if I had to. I also felt obligated to the people that had put money in on that page, you know, who had contributed to the Patreon, because they, in essence, believed that they were helping to create a season 2, which they did. If I hadn't have gotten the money back from season 1, there would have not been a season 2.
At current, will there be a season 3? Or if that's not necessarily on the cards, what financially or creatively would you need to do to get there? Like, what did a season run you, if you're willing to share that number-ish?
Yeah, no, I mean, I can absolutely share the numbers.
Numbers!
numbers are fine. So there is not a season 3 because I was never able to monetize. I tried 3 or 4 different avenues that were what I thought would be successful. I could, because of the license, I couldn't do either of them or any of them. So the first season was a very lean $3,500, cost me just under $4,000. The second season bumped up between 5,000 and 7,000, and that was the cast increased. I think the cast doubled. I also started pulling in some professional voice actors, which charged greater rate. I was also trying to do some new music and sound things, and so equipment and that kind of stuff kind of punched it up. A third season was probably at least going to be the same, if not more, just because, again, I wanted to kind of raise the production value, but at the very least, it was going to need to hit somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 at minimum. And that's not even like, I'm not even paying myself for my time. I'm just making it. If I wanted to be paid for my time, it would have been a $10,000 project. And that's what I went looking for. I went looking for $10,000 to do season 3, and I could not get it. And as much as I appreciate being able to use the Patreon to sort of get some of that funding, it was not going to reach 10,000.
So kind of working backwards from that, if it's costing you $10,000 to produce these 2 seasons worth of material, which is coming out to about 20 episodes, and each episode seems to be 30 to 40 minutes.
20, 30 minutes. Yeah.
You're now looking at a environment where you're essentially 150 views is a dollar. So now suddenly you need a CPM of $6 to cover that, which is not unreasonable for niche content that would be able to highly direct someone towards a thing. I think the other thing about fictional locations is they were trying to avoid mixing IPs where has a fictional location they've made up, and then suddenly these 2 things are conflated. Like if you had done Port Saga novels or something like that, that only was vaguely informed by it, kind of like a 50 Shades of Grey Twilight scenario. But so I can kind of understand it. It seems that Paradox as a license holder is highly risk averse in terms of trying new ventures. They don't generally do a lot of their own writing except for the core books anymore. Knowing that you wouldn't get formal support from the license holder, would you have changed anything, or would you just go into this knowing that it was a non-monetizable, largely passion project?
I probably would have done the first season differently if I had known that. I probably would have still done the project, but I would have put what was season 1 and season 2 probably into a longer, maybe a 12 episode season, maybe even a 15 if I needed it. But I would have said, okay, here's the thing, because I want to make an audio drama. That part was my own ambition, passions. Like, I wanted to know that if I could do it, and I wanted to learn how to do it, I wanted to see if it was even possible, and how many years of my life it would take off of me, and, you know, to find out how much I do. So that was absolutely, I wouldn't have changed that. What I would have probably changed is the scope of the project. I probably would have potentially even changed the property, the IP. I might have used a different IP knowing that this wasn't. And I also probably would have created it in an actual city. I think one of the biggest problems I had was that I created a fictional city.
So you either would have made it so it more clearly played in their sandbox, or you would have just said, different sandbox, kids. We'll see what we can do.
Yeah.
Do you feel the difficulty of interacting with the license holder in any way tainted this project, or are you still creatively satisfied with how it turned out?
I absolutely am satisfied with how it turned out. I think the series is excellent. And of course, I'm biased, right? But if you've talked to any creators, writers, you know, other podcasters, they always hate what they just did. They do, because and I think that's very valid, because what happens is you have learned the lessons of that thing you have just created. So you are a better creator after it than when you started it. So when you look back, you cringe, you go, oh God, you know, if I had known, if I had done this, if I still feel those things. But why I know it is a good series is because I don't have the I want to hide in shame feeling of like, oh my God, I was like a kindergartner and didn't know what I was doing. No, I really feel like they hold up. Even those earliest episodes, you have to understand, episode one of Port Saga, I had never made an audio drama before. This is the first time I had tried to do this thing. So you can hear my problems that are in those first few episodes. But by the time you're in Port Saga 20, episode 20, there's a night and day difference about the production quality. And that's just from learning how to do it. And I think that, again, if you can look past some of the earlier flaws, it's a good series. And I think that it's definitely, it was a worthwhile project all around. I also appreciate all of the lessons that I learned working with the IP, because that was probably perhaps the most eye-opening experience I had through the whole project. Now, obviously, I was learning how to do audio editing, and I was learning, you know, all of these technical aspects, which were an uphill climb in some respects, but there was no mountain higher than working with the IP. As much as I think even some of the folks over there enjoyed Port Saga and wanted to see it happen, I didn't feel unsupported by the people. I felt unsupported by the brand, if that makes sense. Or I felt unsupported by the corporate side of it. Because one of the things that they wanted was for me to prove that I was bringing new people to the IP. And if I could not prove I was bringing new people to the IP, then it was a tougher sell in terms of an investment for them.
It is very hard, as we are both fans of role-playing games, it is hard to quantify the value of a person, because you kind of have, you have three different arrangements you can have. You bring in someone new, which almost unto itself is useless if you consider the basic unit of titterpigging to be the table. Unless that person's going to be the storyteller, or unless that person is going to convince a bunch of their friends to do it. At the end of the day, the nature of RPGing is a small group of people around a table telling a story that is meaningful, hopefully, to them. And that's really hard to incept. The second thing you can do is you can maintain a relationship with someone where someone goes, yeah, I don't like V5, or at least I thought I didn't. But this Port Saga thing is pretty cool. And Rachel says it's based on V5, for instance, or something like that, or something that maybe you did another project that's like, oh, this is Children of the Blood or something, or Cult of the Blood Gods or something like that. Maybe I should pick this up. So you take someone who is on the periphery and then you bring them in. And the third one is you deepen or extend it. You take someone from fan to super fan. And now I am so into Vampire right now, rather than getting the Book of Nod, I get the Book of Nod premium edition, where it comes in a cardboard box and Kareem Muammar gives me a high five or something like that if I ever see him. And it is hard to put numbers on those three things. Like my other project mates, the podcast, I thought we were starting out just talking to existing neckbeard mage nerd train fans. At the start, 150% of my audience was Northern European computer programmers, and that was painfully obvious. But as time goes on, you get a 16-year-old girl who, oh, Terry made a weird appearance on this podcast, and now I'm interested in your game. And I'm like, I am woefully unprepared for this new fan to enter my community. And I think the IP is woefully unprepared for that fan to do it. So you, it is an interface of what are your on-ramps to how can the brand receive it? And that is very poorly developed. It is very hard to get data on. Everyone is risk averse and no one knows what they're doing.
And there were essentially, Port Saga was used in a couple of different ways. It was usually a current Vampire fan introducing the IP to someone else. So when they're like, I don't understand what this is, I don't know what this is, they say, go listen to this thing and it will help you teach you the world. The other was a swath of people who had left the IP and came back. And there were multiple stories of people who were either in the LARP clubs or had tabletopped previously and had walked away from that for whatever reason, lifetimes. And then having seen this, gotten curious, heard it, and then it sparked their nostalgia. And so I know one story of a guy who went back to try LARPing and met the new love of his life at LARP. And so there are these stories of people that went back to participate somehow, ran a game at their house, went to a LARP, and restarted a community for themselves based on hearing the podcast. Is that bringing somebody new to the IP? I don't know. Does it count that they left? I don't know. And so just like what you said, trying to define who is going to be a new fan, who is going to be an additional, as callous as it is to say, pocketbook that's going to buy their products, which I understand is absolutely what they want.
That's the literal business.
Yes.
Given the choice between 100 super fans who never buy a book and 100 people who buy the book and never play, the latter is more valuable. And
right.
I get that.
Yes. And I could not quantify what that was going to be for them.
And podcasting, of all platforms, is the one that has the worst audience metrics. We don't know who is listening or where they are. It is weird to look at things like Spotify buying up a whole bunch of platforms and so on. And now suddenly we do have analytics. And the only way we were able to get it is because another Swedish juggernaut was able to put 100,000 tracking cookies in everything. So now, like, I get analytics on the show that's like, yes, 175% of your listeners are male between the ages of 35 yes. and 45. So it's like, oh, wow, that's a keen insight. I need to go make a donation to the National Organization for Women. Knowing what you know now, how would you change your approach if you were to want to keep it with this IP holder? Is there audience research you would try and do ahead of time? Would there be calls to action you would include in the episodes? Hey, if you're enjoying yourself, please fill out this audience survey.
Perhaps. I probably also would have, I think, created a reel, which I did not do. I didn't say, here's what it would sound like. And I think, so that was immediately, you are an unknown. Yes, we know that you're a writer, but we don't know what level of professionalism this will be at. And so we're going to walk away from it. I would have absolutely come in and said, here is a sample of the thing that I want to create. I would have probably only stuck to a sample of what I wanted to create. And then I also think that I probably would have done more research in terms of that target audience, like you were saying, trying to dig in a little bit more. But that would have been, in my mind, still impossible, because how was I going to know who it was going to be downloaded by? My target audience was originally women, because one of the biggest podcasting listening groups are women who are cleaning their house. And so I was sort of like, well, there's a bunch of us that were vampire fans. And so I thought this was going to be a great way to kind of bring women into the IP. And no, it was 30 to 45 year old dudes that were into it. I think that my assumptions for who was going to enjoy it were also flawed. And if they were going to be flawed going into it, then whatever information I had given them was also going to be flawed.
I want to see the Vampire True Crime podcast. I think that would be fascinating. You follow hunters or members of the Second Inquisition who are trying to piece this together, and suddenly we have You'll Miss Me When I'm Gone, but for vampires. Please make that exist. But also, yeah, that difficulty of audience. I ran a survey in 2019, slightly pre-pandemic, about like, hey, who buys what in the Who Now? And it was pretty fascinating to find out that after getting 2,000 people to fill this out, it turns out the World of Darkness is vampire fans and the other games they like. That yeah. any cross-correlation between lines is entirely down to that. And demographically, it was kind of a real kick to be like, oh, only 20% of my respondents were non-male it was disproportionately people playing V5. So there's this weird U-shaped distribution where women in the world of darkness are disproportionately likely to be under 25 or over 45. Weird demographic things that come out the other end of it. And what advice now do you have either on the production side for someone who wants to do their first audio drama or who wants to work with this IP and do so sustainably? What advice do you have, if any, for creators that might want to do that?
Well, for anybody that wants to make an audio drama, you just got to try. You just got to start, and you just have to know that when you start, it's going to be bad. You are not going to be good at the thing that you just try to do. Or you have a lot of money and you can pay the expert people that you want to make it. But for most people, it's going to be shoestring budgets, Band-Aids and baling wire, and trying to get it done. And just understand that you're doing it because you're curious. And you want to make something. As far as working with the brand, I would have probably tried to have laid a lot more groundwork. I probably would have had agreements up front. I think that if somebody wants to work sustainably with the IP, that those conversations need to start early and have to have a willingness to accept that it's going to take a long time. And also, I think getting in touch with other licensors who already have licenses with the IP is smart. So if you can go through something like Renegade Games speaking specifically with Vampyre and Paradox and World of Darkness, if you can go to Renegade Games or you can go to Level Up Dice or you can go to BNS or if you can go to one of these that already have a license to help them usher you through the process or make connections for you, I think one of the things that I was naive about was just knocking on their door.
And now to kind of the other half of things you have done. Again, I normally hate using the term creative, but that seems to apply to someone who's done so many different things. You first came onto my radar as a LARP writer, someone doing the creative portion of a LARP. What is it like doing large LARPs, kind of, for lack of a better term, at scale, that level where it can no longer be done by just one person managing a Boffer LARP in a park or one person doing a parlor LARP in their living room? What are the unique challenges faced by that? And what is it like going from this is something that we all do and people pay me in beer to I'm charging admission?
Yes. Well, that has been a really interesting growing market, I think, in immersive experiences across, the United States. I think that we were a lot of people who were sort of like, what hotel ballroom can we get for a night to get together and do some LARPing versus actually getting to the point where people are charging tickets. And in some cases, in these blockbuster LARPs, they're charging huge amounts, huge ticket prices, and are actually getting sort of a full, I don't want to call it a vacation because I don't know that any LARP is a vacation, but getting meals and hotels and the experience itself included in that. And I think that the difference is obviously the market, people's willingness to want to do that. But I also think that people in general have grown tired of the ad hoc nature of some of the LARPs and the problems that come with them. So when you aren't paying an admission fee or you aren't paying a ticket price, you aren't quite sure what your experience is going to be. You know that if you're going to pay a ticket price, that there is going to be at least a base understanding of what you're going to get out of that situation. And that's why I think that's why they're growing in popularity. I also understand that on the writing side, that is an entirely different situation because now you go from somebody who has written their own sheet in most cases. Like, if they're coming in to do a vampire LARP, they've created a sheet at home. Even this is tabletop too. They've created their sheet. They come into the story, they play their thing. And you as a storyteller are shepherding them in this or helping resolve their issues or facilitating their role play in the environment. When you start getting into the, I am now going to charge tickets and you are going to get a character and you are going to be part of what is essentially in many ways a theatrical performance, it becomes a lot more heavy on the writing side. There's a lot more responsibility on the writing side. And there is also an expectation that the writing has to be at a certain level, which you would forgive at a pickup LARP will no longer be forgiven for paid LARP. A customer would need to feel connected to the character and as though they had the information that they needed to play, and also that their experience was enhanced by the connections and character connections and the connection that they have to the plot of the LARP. So the expectations are very different.
Are there any other subtle changes that occur when you switch from a social economy to a financial economy? Does it, for instance, if you're growing from an existing LARP base, does it change the relationship you have with the players? Like, I think it's Dan Ariely gives the example of, even if someone puts their back into producing a great Thanksgiving, everyone would be insulted if you offered the person who invited you $200, because that's what its value would have been if you had gone out to a fancy restaurant to do it. And now we're doing the opposite. You are charging for something that was previously free. What are kind of those subtle changes that you think that maybe people don't consider or pick up on?
Well, there is definitely a class aspect that is forming. I think probably the most unfortunate aspect of the for-paid LARP community is it is creating a division between those who can afford it and those who can't. And that those who can afford it, I mean, you have to understand, I have worked on a number of games that I could not afford to attend. So I've been paid as a writer. And the only reason that you would see me there is because either the producers wanted me out there for staffing reasons, or I'm working as a facilitator on the LARP. And that's because I can't, as a freelancer and a very bohemian household, can't afford tickets to the LARPs I'm writing. And so it is keeping, I believe, a lot of people who are excellent role players and people who would be incredible additions to the community out of it. And it is instead becoming a pay-to-play environment in some cases, where because somebody has the money to pay for the ticket, there is already a different pool of people that is being pulled from for those experiences. And I don't know how to solve the problem, because you have huge production costs. There was a vampire LARP that I was going to put on in Houston, where the base costs for the event before you bought things that you needed was $20,000. To walk into the space was $20,000. So there is this situation where it's sort of like, you have to be able to get the event space. You have to be able to pay for the event space. You have to be able to support the event that you're creating. And it becomes a matter of how creative can I get with the LARP that we're doing. For example, the Mage Noir LARP that was at the Masons. It was based on a relationship. They had the relationship allowed us to get an event space that was more affordable. So then the ticket prices could be lower. But I think the economics of it right now are probably the most difficult and controversial aspect of sort of what you're talking about right now.
To me, when you say the economics, there are economics writ large is a question of how do we allocate scarce resources? And that is not always money. Me looking at this, the two additional scarce resources besides money is going to be time. I get a finite number of vacation days every year, so I want those to be absolute blowouts. So I am in a higher money, lower time relationship as opposed to when I was in college or high school, where it was a high time, low money thing. Everything is seeing this. I'm active in Scouts BSA, and parents are looking, they are perfectly comfortable paying someone else to run a quality program for their child. They're no longer interested in, this is how a bored housewife with 7 hours to kill in a day can do an activity for 15 children only using brown paper bags, a bunch of cotton balls, and some straws. That era is gone, which is annoying because we had a lot of program geared towards that, that low money, high time environment. And with the LARP, you have players who are looking for the best experience, which selects for a certain strata of player or group of players that are willing to pay for that. And then the drive is then another finite resource is your creative talent. There is a class of people that can run a blockbuster LARP with amazing writing, good production, and set designs. And now the question is, what are the incentives? If there's a demand for 15 of these to be put on in a year and there's only 10 being done, reducing the cost doesn't help. Like, it's right. going to sell out anyway. So right. there is an incentive to kind of go towards that high end. Your neighborhood LARPs, where it's a bunch of friends, that hasn't changed necessarily too much. That is going to change based on who is free when, what public spaces are available. We could also have the conversation of the privatization of public spaces and the fact that there aren't nearly as many parks and you can't do it in a mall and the death of the public square. What do you see that could be done to kind of fill in that middle? Do we just need a new generation of creatives to say, no, I'm going to do a LARP. I'm going to charge $25 a year to cover my beer money and the small amount of incidentals that come upon that? Or do you think that's just kind of dead in the same way that Hollywood doesn't produce prestige movies that were described to me as adults in nice places talking to each other?
Yes, I move a match. If you remember Eddie Izzard, I move a matchbox here, I move a matchbox here. So anyway, yeah, I actually think it's going to come from the customer base rather than from the production side. Because I think there are a lot of producers who would love to find ways that would make it more affordable. I think that event space is one of the major issues, at least in the US economy. Being able, whether it's getting a hotel, whether it's getting even just Airbnbs, it's become enormously expensive to get property. And so that is an American problem. And that is one of the limiting factors, because I think that if we could get some of those property event costs down, then it could be more affordable. The other side of it is the willingness for the customer to understand the situation the producer is in. And I think that instead of having a more understanding audience, the audience, understandably, I'm coming from the creative side of this, is becoming more demanding, is because they want more amenities with their ticket. They want those amenities to be luxury class without paying luxury prices. They want in-depth character sheets that give them a robust understanding of their character and the world that they're in without having to pay writers. You know, I don't know how to facilitate that conversation. And I don't know how to have that conversation with the LARP audience to say, listen, y'all, just bring it down a couple of notches and understand that then in most of these cases, it's people who love what they're doing, believe they are, I don't know, creating art in the way that they can. But I also think some of it ends up being a little deceptive, because as you see better production in graphic design and advertising and websites, you know, digital tools allow things to look slicker than they actually are. And so you are experiencing or expecting this very professional, everybody's professional, I don't like that word, but do you kind of understand what I'm saying? Like, you expect like Disney level productions at a $200 ticket. And you're like, no, this is not tenable.
My favorite example of that are movie props. They look great on the screen. None of them are designed to be held by a normal human close to the face. It is frequently the case that cosplayers produce a better quality product than the prop that was used on set. Because even Christopher Nolan, filming in 70mm IMAX, knows that there's only a finite degree of resolution that's going to be. The TARS that I saw at Dragon Con is a higher fidelity model than the TARS that was literally used in the production of Interstellar.
Oh yeah, like when you see medieval goblets, they're foam. Goblets are foam, and walls are foam.
And even that hero prop where it's the book that gets a close-up has no back.
Yes.
Like it is, we know precisely the portion of the ancient tome that is being covered in rubies and gems and so on. And why bother with the other side?
Right, exactly.
And I also feel like some of the things that are working against us are, one, those design skills are becoming a little bit more ubiquitous. More people just know how to use InDesign and Photoshop and everything. So it is hard to just be good at one thing. Mage the Podcast wouldn't exist without our producer, who has a background in graphic design, and his 10 hours a month interfacing makes our show look vastly more polished than the 40 hours I put in running, reading, and editing interviews. And I am intensely aware of that. But it also seems like, just as the amount of culture available builds up, this knowledge that there are homemade, homespun, enjoyable things are still fun. It almost feels like there is a change in the nature of play, that it is no longer this theater of the mind thing, that we really want the visuals to follow up. And I don't know how we change that either. I have dim hopes that the death of the American mall suddenly gives us inexpensive event spaces again.
Oh, yeah, that or something would be nice. Like, yeah.
And I think it's also the case that the nature of risk-taking has changed, where previously you could run a LARP out of an abandoned warehouse. I don't really see that being done anymore, which may be a good thing. I don't know. But those, as we mentioned earlier, those creative spaces are seemingly going away. Any other concerns or thoughts you have about kind of the state of LARPing in 2023?
No, I like the aspects of artistic elevation. I like the productions people are trying to do. I like that they are trying to make them more and more immersive and more innovative in some of those ways. I think that has been a real boon to LARPing, but I also think that with everything comes a whole new set of problems.
You are multi-capable. What do you have on the horizon? Or alternatively, if someone said, hey, Rachel, what are you looking to get into next? You seem to be a skill builder, someone who just kind of pack rats and squirrels away creative abilities. What do you feel is on your horizon?
That would be true. I always have this problem of deciding I was going to do something and then I'm not allowing myself to fail at it. That is actually probably not a great personality trait to have, because sometimes, you know, it's best to just walk away. But I have a very difficult time walking away from things. I do have a couple of projects on the horizon. I am now working with Studio Hermitage as their writer designer, and they are creating their own IP. And is speaking of Vampire, Justin Achille went from World of Darkness to Studio Hermitage and has hired me on as writer designer as they develop a new IP. So now I am in the corporate sphere, which is eye-opening. I'm on some of the other sides of those conversations, which is also a very interesting outlook when you're talking about protecting your brand and having expectations for maintaining a certain level of brand. Personally, I have started another script for an audio drama, but it is not connected to an IP. I have decided that I'm going to create an audio drama that is totally original. And one of the things that has been very nerve-wracking for me that I have been back and forth with is if anybody will care. So that's one of the dilemmas that I had in working on Port Saga, is that Port Saga in many ways had a built-in audience. I can say it's Vampire the Masquerade, and there are people out there who will give it a try just because I said it was Vampire the Masquerade. If I say, hey, come listen to this audio drama that you know nothing about, they might be like, okay, maybe. I am concerned that in breaking out on my own, because it's so much easier, I'm just going to say right now, working on your own original, building your own original IP is infinitely more easier than working with a licensor. I have had stories with World of Darkness and Herbert Foundation with Dune. And it is difficult to do. And you are limited by your creative choices. In some ways, you have to get approvals for the things that you do, which can change the story that you're creating, the characters that you're creating. It has to fit within somebody else's vision. Having the originality of working on my own vision is freeing, but then you also risk the idea of, is anybody going to care about it? I might make another podcast and the audience will be crickets. I don't know.
What do you consider the Rachel J. Wilkinson brand to be? Because another way of starting a new thing is...
It's funny you should ask that, because shit if I know.
Okay. Because periodically, as someone who spends $3,000 to $7,000 a year on RPG products, sometimes I buy it because it's fascinating. I'm like, oh, they made an RPG out of Bluey. Sure, yeah. Let's see what this is. But in other cases, I'm like, oh, Fred Hicks is on this. Yes, it is billed as a game where two hypersentient cats teach a goldfish how to read in a post-apocalyptic American West. But Fred Hicks is on it. And that's the thing I believe in. And kind of as someone who has these 10,000 hustles, seeing the sheer number of places your name is on, it was like suddenly realizing how many products contain propylene glycol. You're like, oh, this is Rachel J. Wilkinson. Oh, this is Rachel J. Wilkinson in it too. Should I be limiting my exposure to this? No.
I'm a carcinogenic.
The state of California has found Rachel J. Wilkinson to get, yeah. If you can get there, I will get that as a bumper sticker on my car. What is it like as a creative to try and figure out what that brand is? Or is it just one of those things where you say, hey, I did all these things, pick the thing that makes sense for you, person who's willing to pay me. We'll go from there.
It's a little bit of both. My first writing gig was standing in Danielle Harper's kitchen, crying, begging for a job because I had lost some work when I was doing the educational company. I lost some work. And so I was freaking out about my future. And Danielle was a developer for Onyx Path. And
Danielle Lozon, as people may be used to seeing her in the production.
Lozon Harper. Yes. Anyway, she was sitting there in her kitchen and there was just, you know, tears down streaming down my face, being like, please just give me some words. And so the first project she gave me was 3,000 words on The Brood. So it Vampire the Requiem, Night Horrors, I believe the book was. And so The Brood write-up is me. And that was the first gig. And so part of it is, what is the material that somebody will give you? Fast forward to Modiphius and my Dune work. Originally, I saw the press release for their core book. And I, having been a Dune fan for my entire existence, said I was born for this moment. And I ended up writing the developer. And I sent a resume. And I literally said, I am born for this moment. Put me in, coach. You have no idea what I can do for you. And it was definitely going in. And Andy Peregrin, who is a joy, did email me back and said, give me three pitches. And which I did. And he said, I have no work for you right now. Then fast forward a couple of months, he had a writer on the core book that had left the project and he needed the chapter on storytelling written in 2 weeks. And I said, I'm your gal. We're going to do this. So in some ways, it's whatever somebody is going to give you. The other is also, what are you in love with? I was in love with Dune. I am now their line editor, going through all of the stages, going up from writing a chapter all the way. And it's the same way with Vampire as well. So some of it is you do something successful and they say, oh, you're very good at this. Let's give you this project and let's give you the next project. And then you suddenly realize all I write is Vampire. and then they give me Vampires in Space, right? Because that's Dune. So I definitely think part of my brand is some sort of political something. There's always kind of something going on. There's always something also a little spooky going on. So I know that I'm going to try to lean into my Gothic roots so that if I were to say, what is a Rachel J. Wilkinson brand? It's something that's probably going to be a little gothy, even if it's a little space gothy. So
Gothic roots is also a hair salon that I would go to. I'm just putting that out there. Yeah. But I'm glad to see that the Dunk RPG, as I call it, because that is the weirdest logo, is a fascinating game because it shows how 2D20 is not a system like GURPS. It is an alphabet. It is something that is used to create one. And it is interesting comparing Star Trek, where the fact that I buried the hatchet with my ex-boyfriend allows me to blow up the Borg cube at the end. And it creates a Star Trek episode. And then you play Dunk and it's like, you have an advantage. You have a 9-second window to take advantage of it. And if you don't, you will be crushed by Baron Harkonnen. What do you do? And you're like, you look at your character sheet, you're like, I'm going to use the computer with conviction roll. Yes. And it's a fascinating game. My first exposure to it, the person did not realize that Dune and Octone Cthulhu do not use the same system. So that was interesting. So it very quickly turned into this Bridgerton / Downton Abbey, Atreides, upstairs, downstairs game where there were just furtive glances between a chief butler and a many member of the Bean Hat. Benedictines, purposely mispronounce everything in Dune. But yeah, needless to say, I look forward to seeing those when I can get them for 25% off on Game Nerds. So thank you for continuing to write that. It's pretty fascinating to read. And if we're interested in following all of these projects or possibly seeing the hair salon that you open, Gothic Roots, where can we do that?
You can go to rachelwilkinson.com, which is my website. You can also go to Ray J. Wilkinson on Twitter if it still exists tomorrow. Yeah. And you can also, I got Facebook, Instagram, you know, you can find me in all those. I will say I'm not a great social media user, so it's sometimes a little tough to follow me, but usually I'll poke my head up occasionally.
And if you are listening to this because you like Maids of the Podcast, Rachel also did a podcast series called Life-mancy with the amazing tagline of My Life Was a Dumpster Fire, So I Turned to Witchcraft. And if that doesn't represent a third of mage factions, I don't know what does. And links to all of those will be in the show notes. Rachel, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It was a great time. I love chatting with you. The werewolf player, the mage player, and the vampire player have different core personalities. To like the thing that drives them, the thing that, you know, what is it that attracted them to this particular fan base is different.
Yeah, werewolf asks the question, are you a lacrosse fan? Yes, no. And if the answer is no, you play a different game.